Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Johanna Pink, Professor of Islamic Studies at the University of Freiburg, Germany, about her co-edited volume with Andreas Gorka, Tafsir and Islamic Intellectual History, Exploring the Boundaries of a Genre, published by Oxford University Press in 2014. What does it mean to interpret the Quran? What kinds of literary genres have produced and continue to produce such inquiry? Is tafsir only a line-by-line commentary, or could it be something broader, blended with genres of law, storytelling, translation? Whose authority counts and why? Tafsir and Islamic Intellectual History aims to address these questions and more in its ambitious agenda. Johanna Pink and Andreas Gorka have provided a great service to the field of Quranic studies by compiling this fine volume, penned by 15 established as well as rising scholars in the field. The book is conveniently organized according to 5 sections, which explore the challenges of Quranic exegesis in modern and pre-modern contexts. The authors also explore a number of languages and geographical regions, which showcases the diverse expressions of exegesis that Muslims have produced over the centuries. Pink's own chapter in the volume, for example, analyzes the exegetical works of Yemeni scholar Muhammad al-Shawkani and provocatively argues that labels, such as modern or Salafi, have their uses but can nonetheless introduce other problematics, and readers should be careful before assuming an easy fit into any of these categories. In addition to appealing to Quranic studies scholars of many stripes, this edited volume also presents itself as a reference work, given its broad scope, meticulous notes, and extensive bibliography, and should therefore appeal to diverse readers accordingly. I hope you enjoy the interview, and without further ado, here's my conversation with Johanna Pink. Good morning, Johanna. Thanks for joining us today on New Books in Islamic Studies.
Good morning, Elliot.
So today we're going to do something a little bit unusual, which is we're going to talk about an edited volume that you co-edited and incorporate a discussion of a forthcoming monograph that you have. So yeah. I'm excited about that. And the way we like to start our interviews in New Books in Islamic Studies is to invite authors to first tell us a little bit about themselves and how they became interested in Islamic studies. So could you tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah, I'm now a tenured professor in Islamic studies at a German university, the University of Freiburg. I've been here for 5 years, and I started to do Islamic studies or to study it in 1992. And at the time, it was not a very political subject. It was a very exotic one. So I was mainly interested in religion and also in studying Arabic, which I was fascinated by. So I didn't actually know a lot about Islam or about the Middle East or anything of that kind. I was just interested. And I think I've maintained my fascination with learning languages. So I'm working with a number of languages in my research besides Arabic. And I've also maintained my fascination with religion, and particularly Islam and various forms of expression of Islam, which is in Germany, Islamic studies are a very broad field that encompass everything that would be Middle Eastern studies and Middle Eastern history in the U.S., so you do not necessarily have to be particularly interested in religion to do it, but that was my original motivation, and I think I maintained that kind of motivation, which is what eventually also led me to focus on Quranic exegesis and Quran translations.
Could you say a little bit about how you became interested in the Quran, especially since one of your first projects was related to religious diversity in Egypt, which doesn't have an ostensible connection to Quranic studies, but could you help us understand the trajectory a little bit?
Yeah, I guess it started when I studied with Stefan Wild in Bonn, who at the time became very interested in the Quran, and he also edited a book, The Quran as Text. And he was friends with Nasser Hamid Abu Zayd and invited him to a class we had on the Quran. And I learned a lot of fascinating things in this class. I heard for the first time about people such as Farid Esak and Mahmoud Muhammad Taha. And then when I, you are right that when I did my PhD, I focused on religious minorities and Muslim positions on religions or religious communities that are not accepted by Islam and also by most Middle Eastern states. So this was entirely unrelated. But then my interest in the Quran returned first through teaching. I taught a number of classes on the Quran and Quranic exegesis, which was when I realized that the state of research on modern and contemporary Quranic exegesis was very shallow in my from my perspective, and mostly focusing on a specific set of ideas and neglecting a lot of other things that were going on. And then I was also, for career reasons, I was looking for a second big field after the topic of my PhD to work in, because this is what you need to do in Germany to get a tenured position, quite simply. So since I also had a young family at the time and couldn't do extensive fieldwork in the Middle East, doing research on Quranic commentaries seemed like a perfect solution, because it allowed me to integrate my interest in the Quran, in religious discourses, in different languages, and to do this mostly at my desk. So this is how I started. And since then, of course, I've also done fieldwork and all kinds of things.
I look forward to asking you more about your field work in a little bit. Before we start talking about the edited volume, could you tell us how you became involved with this particular project and your editor, Andreas Gorka?
Yeah, Andreas and me, we were both based in Berlin at the time. And I was starting to be interested to do projects in Tafsir, because I was doing research on contemporary Quranic exegesis myself at the time, and I was just starting in this field, so I wanted to broaden my knowledge and my focus. And Andreas is a specialist in early Islamic history and intellectual history, so this seemed like an ideal combination, because he had all the knowledge and contacts that I did not have, and vice versa. So we decided to organize a conference on Tafsir and to apply for funding, which was successful. And we had this conference in 2010. And after that, it was a very long process until the book was finally published in 2014. And it also, it evolved from a kind of conference volume to a very different co-edited volume that contains a number of papers that weren't presented at the conference, whereas some of the papers that were presented at the conference are not present in the book for various reasons. So, it was a long process during which we also very much developed and focused our ideas.
And it's obviously a very rich text, and that is answering this issue of what is tafsir and what is the genre. And so jumping into the text, even starting with the title, what is tafsir? Can you, in your own words, tell the listeners what this word means?
Yeah, there's a certain tension in this word, because on the one hand, it is often used quite in a very broad sense to denote everything that has to do with the interpretation of the Quran. And on the other hand, in a narrow sense, it is a specific genre of scholarship, of Islamic scholarship, the Quranic commentary, which again has various subgenres, but they all follow specific rules, for example, with respect to the sources they use, to the methods they use, to the general structure, and so on. So there's always this tension between tafsir in the narrow sense and tafsir in the broader sense. And for us, the question was, where are the boundaries? So where's the point at which you wouldn't speak of tafsir any longer, and for what reason? How is it related to other genres that a lot of them actually use the same sources? and some of the same methods. And obviously the Quran is important for practically all genres of Islamic scholarship. So how are they related to tafsir? And what kinds of tafsir are there? These were the questions that we wanted to answer.
So could you give us an example of something that might regularly, straightforwardly fit under the category of tafsir, and then something that pushes the boundaries a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, the most common sense application of the word tafsir refers to mainstream, mostly Sunni Quranic commentaries, although there are also a few Shi'i works that fit the category, which is a straightforward Quranic commentary that comments on the entire text of the Quran in its canonical order, first by first or even segment by segment, and discusses all the exegetical problems related to it, referring to previous exegetical authorities, and often also quoting multiple opinions on one and the same problem. So this is the classical format. The question of boundaries was often negotiated in relation to esoteric approaches. And there has been a very recent volume on esoteric approaches to the Quran, which I'm very excited about, because this is really a very interesting field. So this was one issue which was always contested also for political reasons. It had a lot to do with the ascent of the Fatimid Caliphate and the desire of a lot of Sunnis to oppose it by pointing to their allegedly heretical or unacceptable way of interpreting the Quran. There were always attempts to experiment. Like we have Quranic commentaries that, for example, that don't use diacritical signs. So they only use letters that don't have dots below, above, or whatever, which is very weird. And we don't exactly know why somebody did something like that. But the point is that it was very hard for such works to be accepted into the mainstream tradition of tafsir, because they were just so different from what tafsir was doing. And then in recent years, there's also been an increasing focus on a Quranic exegesis that has been carried out in other genres, such as polemical works, for example, or narrative works of prophetic history, some of them are profoundly exegetical, or even they even offer hermeneutical theories, but they also had a very hard time to make the transition into actual works of tafsir in the narrow sense.
And so given that, I mean, as you're clearly articulating, this is a contested category that could be fluid. And so given that, how did you negotiate the scope of the volume and the kinds of contributors you wanted and the kinds of questions you wanted to ask? What was the process like of putting the edited volume together logistically?
Yeah, it was a very long process, as I said. And in the beginning, we had this conference, and that was a combination of inviting participants. So we invited specific persons, and we wanted it to be a mix of senior scholars, but also emerging scholars. So we had participants such as Andrew Rippin and Claude Gilliot, but also people who were working on their PhD thesis. And then we also had a call for papers, because we wanted to have a chance to include interesting young scholars whom we hadn't heard about yet, which always happens. In the beginning, we were thematically quite open, because we felt that there was at the time so little research on the field of tafsir that anything which was kind of exploring the boundaries of this genre and its relation to other genres and its internal structure would be helpful for further scholarship. And in the process of editing this volume, and especially when we decided to have it published by Oxford University Press in collaboration with the Institute for Ismaili Studies, who were very much involved in the editorial process, we focused it more and more on a specific set of questions, and we discussed them with the authors, and so the whole thing took shape over a period of at least 2 or 3 years. And also, unfortunately, I have to say a few contributions that we would have liked to retain dropped out for various reasons, which weakened some areas that we would have liked to include, especially the question of Shi'i and of mystical tafsir, so the whole esotericism issue, which is why I'm so happy that there's no volume specifically on that.
Uh-huh. And in the introduction, and you've mentioned it as well, but you specifically note that there's no comprehensive history of tafsir that has yet to be written, and that it's been an understudied area within Islamic studies. Could you say a little bit about that, about what your sense is of why that's the case, especially since, as you know, like the Quran is at the center of Muslim discourses?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think this perception that the Quran is at the center of Muslim discourses is actually a pretty recent phenomenon, because it has taken center stage as opposed to fields like Kalam or Usul al-Fiqh in recent decades for a lot of reasons that I've gone into in my more recent project. But the Quran is, of course, central and has always been central to a certain extent for all fields of scholarship. The interesting thing is that in Islamic studies until at least the 1990s, there was this near exclusive interest in what the Quran actually says. So there were studies on the Quran from a literary or historical perspective, but there was little interest in tafsir because it was felt that because most works of tafsir have been written so much later than the Quran and are so obviously influenced by the theological and juridical and philological, et cetera, debates that took place in their author's time, it was felt that they could offer us very little concerning a proper understanding of the Quran. And there was little interest in reading Quranic commentaries as works in their own right that have a specific set of methods, a specific history, and that can tell us something beyond the actual meaning of the Quran. This also, I think, had to do with a very Western perspective on issues or on concepts such as authenticity, originality, innovation. So there was a certain interest in the formative period of tafsir, but the classical period, which starts about in the 10th century CE, was usually considered as repetitive, uncreative, unoriginal, or even sclerotic, because there was so much, they were all taking part in the same discourses and there was a lot of repetition. But there were also, of course, reasons for that, and there were still a lot of works that had their own merits and their own reasons for being, for example, part of madrasa curricula. But this was something that a lot of scholars were not interested in. Something that's very indicative of that trend is the near complete lack of interest in the hashia or the gloss on Quranic commentaries, which was a central part of the way in which exegesis was performed until the 19th century. But we know hardly anything about it because I think the only scholar who has actually paid attention to it in the modern period is Walid Saleh. But most other scholars feel that it doesn't really merit a lot of attention because it's not an original work. And so this whole concept of a work having to be an original work, whatever that means, is very problematic if you look at the history of a genre of scholarship.
Right.
I think the result of all this was that there was very little interest in tafsir in itself. Tafsir works were mainly consulted to get at the meaning of some expressions in the Quran, but not really studied. This has changed, fortunately, in the past 25 years, I think.
And this issue of originality versus not novelty, you get at, several of your authors get at this by looking at particular
exegetes and seeing what they contribute and how they are different from other people. And so in your own chapter, entitled Where Does Modernity Begin? Muhammad al-Shawkani and the Tradition of Tafsir, you look at a particular Yemeni scholar. And could you tell us about who this is? Who's Muhammad al-Shawkani, and why did you choose to write a chapter about him?
Yeah, Shawkani was the preeminent Yemeni scholar of his time. He was he lived from 1760 to 1835 in Sana'a. He was born a Zaydi, which is a branch of Shia Islam that was also the ruling denomination, if you want to put it that way, in Yemen at the time. But Shawkani more or less turned to a form of Sunnism, and specifically a form of Sunnism that rejected the legal schools. So he didn't want to be part of any specific madhab, but he relied on the Sunni hadith collections, for example. So he more or less renounced the Zaydi tradition and became part of some kind of scripturalist, or you could also call it fundamentalist Sunni tradition, which was quite pervasive at the time in various regions of the Muslim world. And Shawkani wrote a lot of things. There's also, by the time I wrote my article, there was already a very interesting monograph on Shawkani by Bernard Haeckel. The interesting thing, and that's quite symptomatic, is that none of the works I found about Shawkani talked about his tafsir. They talk about his legal works, fatwas, and whatever. But there was hardly anything about his tafsir other than mention of the fact that it exists. So obviously a lot of scholars had looked at it and didn't really know what to do with it.
Right.
So this was a main reason for me to approach him. And the other reason was chronological, because he wrote at a time at the beginning of the 19th century that is usually, at least with respect to Yemen, seen as belonging to the pre-modern period. So he is usually considered a traditional or classical or whatever exegete. And I was wondering whether this is actually true. So This was my main interest for looking at him.
Right. And you know, as well, you talk about how in the Encyclopedia of the Quran, these categories are broken down into modern and pre-modern, which you have some reservations about as well. So how does Shawkani push the boundaries of modern and pre-modern in terms of where you would want to classify him as an exegete?
Well, first of all, I think it does make sense to talk of a modern period if you mean by it the period that starts or that manifests some kind of reaction to Western influence. So at the end of the 19th century, you have Quranic commentaries that try to explain how rational Islam is, that try to give rational explanations for miracles in the Quran, that are skeptical of polygamy and slavery and other institutions that are seen critical by Western observers. You have a lot of apologetic content and so on. All of this is completely absent from Shawkani's commentary. He doesn't have any issues with things like the evil eye, for example. This is just out of the question for him. It exists, so he writes about it. He doesn't have any. He doesn't see any necessity to defend the institution of slavery or anything of that kind. So in that sense, it's clearly a pre-modern work. But at the same time, I felt that there are actually different strands of pre-modern tafsir that are quite different in their hermeneutical outlook. And there's one strand which you could call scripturalist or fundamentalist, which Shawkani is representative of. And this strand becomes very prominent in the 19th century and is directly appropriated and adopted by a lot of modernist exegetes such as Rashid Rida or Jamal ad-Din al-Qasimi. So this idea of a clear rupture between the early 19th century and the late 19th century somehow is called into question by my results, I think.
Mm-hmm. And you throw in some other terms that could be problematized as well, such as fundamentalist or scripturalist. And you have this nice quote that I'd like to invite your commentary on from your chapter. So you're talking about what it would mean to call someone like a Shawkani Salafi. And so you mentioned that he does not actually hold particular respect for the interpretations offered by the Salaf, namely the Companions and the Tabi'un, and does not consider them more valuable than those of later scholars, and certainly not more authoritative than his own. So could you say a little bit about what we mean in general when we talk about Salafi or Salafi exegesis? And then could you say how a Shawkani lines up with this area?
Yeah, the term Salafi is very problematic because it's changed meaning and over time, and it's also often used for very different phenomena. So today it's mostly associated with people who more or less follow the methodology of Ibn Taymiyyah. And for Ibn Taymiyyyah, actually, he wrote an introduction to the methods of Quranic exegesis. And for him, actually, the Salaf, the first generations of Islam, held a very high degree of authority. So they came right after the Prophet. And if there was any authentic tradition about something the Salaf said about the Quran, it had to be followed, at least in theory. Shawkani is often also labeled a Salafi today, although certainly Shawkani didn't use that label for himself. Because he has some of the same ideas, namely that you should follow scriptural proof rather than the opinions of later legal scholars or exegetical authorities and so on. So if you have some clear evidence from the Quran or the Sunnah, then you should follow it in its more or less literal sense. He actually has a quite sophisticated idea of what that literal sense could be, but he's definitely against, allegorical interpretations and things like these. In this sense, he's very close to the methodology of many people who are labeled Salafis. But at the same time, as the quote you just cited says or makes clear, he doesn't actually put much store in the opinions of the Salaf, and he doesn't quote Ibn Taymiyyah anywhere. So I think he was much more influenced by Ibn Hazm, who also became very popular in the late 19th and 20th century. So there's a clear genealogy of ideas that also is very influential in modern times. And
Was a Shawkani reading Ibn Taymiyyah? Was there a reason he didn't like to incorporate him?
I'm not sure, he does quote Ibn Kathir, so he certainly knew. I mean, Ibn Kathir was a disciple of Ibn Taymiyyah, and Shawkani certainly knew Ibn Taymiyyah. I don't know if he knew or had access to the Muqaddimah fi Usul al-Tafsir, but Ibn Kathir quotes much of this work by Ibn Taymiyyah in his own Quranic commentary. So Shawkani must have had some access to it, but he doesn't quote it at all. And Shawkani was very, very interested in bolstering his own authority. So, of course, he wanted to make this argument that a scholar is not more valuable or more authoritative just because he lived earlier than somebody else, because he himself lived relatively late in the context of Islamic history. I would hesitate to call him a Salafi, but he has certainly been considered a Salafi by many, also in Saudi Arabia. He's considered one of the really acceptable exegetes. But I would definitely call him a scripturalist or fundamentalist in the sense that he that he wants to go back to the sources at the expense of later scholarly traditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting the way you characterize him as someone who wouldn't see the Salaf as having positions that are necessarily more authoritative than his own. It's a provocative, I think, thought experiment on its own to think about what it means to be Salafi or be called Salafi, and then adding in not considering the Salaf authoritative. I think it does a good job of jumbling the category.
Yeah.
And so you've talked a little bit about what you discovered in writing your own chapter about Ash-Shawkani. As a co-editor of the volume, what kinds of surprises or striking things did you learn or encounter from going through the material that you edited from your other contributors? Were there some things or gems of historical insight that really stuck out to you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we were quite happy with with all of the chapters that eventually made it into the book, obviously. And of course, we were always looking for contributions that kind of called into question common categories or perceptions or concepts. For me personally, the chapter written by my co-editor Andreas Görke was very important, and I keep quoting it also because he paid particular attention to media transformation, and I think this is a structural condition of Quranic exegesis in the modern period that is often overlooked. So the media that exegesis takes place in has a direct effect on the one hand, the people who produce exegesis, and on the other hand, the audiences they can reach. And so he goes into this, the results of this process, especially with respect to the internet. And we also, it was very important to us to have pieces that point to the importance of language and of regional differences. I think the last chapter in the volume by Andrew Rippon about the contemporary translation of classical works of tafsir, he was the first person ever to even write about this topic. Because usually, even Quran translations are not studied that often because most people feel that, you could as well look at the Quran itself rather than a translation. And that's even more the case with works of tafsir. You would look at the original Ibn Kathir and not at some possibly not even very academic English translation. But of course, translations are produced for all kinds of reasons and can be interesting to look at for these reasons, for example, with respect to the way in which they make pre-modern works of tafsir accessible to their projected audiences and what they leave out, how they translate technical terms and so on. This was one aspect, and also we also, of course, wanted to address the whole issue of the formative period, which has received more attention in scholarship so far, but where there's also a lot of open questions still, in especially with respect to the interrelation between tafsir and other genres, such as hadith. We were very much surprised by thrilled by the results of Roberto Tortoli's work on the exegetical hadith that are contained in Malik ibn Anas's Muwatta, which is a very important work of hadith. And it contains a number of exegetical hadith that, if you look at them, you would think that any Quranic commentary should quote them because they really say about how to understand the Quran, but the Quranic commentaries just don't. So this is indicative of the fact that at a fairly early time, there was already a development where there was a specific corpus of hadith that were considered part of the exegetical tradition and others were not.
Mm-hmm. So I think this will be a good switching point, talking about translation and what kind of sources certain types of scholars like to use and others don't, as we transition into your current project. One last thing I'd like to ask you about the edited volume before we move on to the next segment is a lot of educators listen to these podcasts, and I like to ask the people I interview about teaching. And so have you had a chance to use this volume in your own teaching? And do you have advice for teachers listening to this podcast, how they might incorporate the volume into their courses?
Well, to be honest, teaching was not the main thing we had in mind. I mean, I think you can use this in teaching as you can use most edited volumes. That is, you can use individual chapters if you teach a class that they could be relevant to. But I think the volume is probably too broad in scope, and some of the chapters are too specialized to make it really the kind of thing you would use for teaching in its entirety, which is actually a big difference to my current project, where I had teaching needs very much in mind when I devised it.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's jump into that then. So you have a monograph forthcoming, which is Muslim Quranic Interpretation Today, Media Genealogies and Interpretive Communities. Mm-hmm. And so when are you expecting that to come out?
The beginning of 2018, according to the publisher.
Uh-huh. So that should be out before too long. And why don't we start off, what are the connections between this current project and the edited volume?
Well, the edited volume was just one piece of, an emerging and evolving interest in tafsir. As you mentioned before, there's no comprehensive history of tafsir yet, and I didn't feel qualified to write such a history either. But I did feel qualified to write a more comprehensive overview of contemporary trends in Quranic interpretation. So this is really what I wanted to do. So this is, in contrast to this edited volume, it's not a collection of papers on individual questions and periods and authors and so on, but it's trying to give readers a broader picture of what is actually happening today. And when I say contemporary, I really mean today, like not like the period since 1900 or something, but really the past 15 years or so.
Well, I think that's really exciting, A, just because it's an interesting topic, but B, I think the challenge that it takes, because I think in a way it's easier to study things that happened a while ago, even as you say, right? Like you can, you don't need to do field work if you can read stuff in libraries. And so in any case, I find it's impressive that you're tackling the very modern question, because I think in a way that brings more difficulty, which is admirable. So it's a good thing in my mind, and I think many, many readers. So you've addressed what you mean by today. What, you look at different regions and languages in your study. Am I right? Can you tell us about the regions and languages that you explore?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, what I'm trying to do in this book, in the first part, I try to look at structural conditions that inform interpretive efforts by Muslims. So one of these structural conditions, for example, is the modern nation state, which is very influential in many ways, for example, by shaping educational systems, also by establishing official languages and scripts and so on. So this is one factor I'm by necessity, I read quite a number of languages, but I'm still limited. There are certain languages, there are a lot of languages that I don't read, and therefore regions I can't go into. But I think I can still take the languages I read as examples and derive structural observations from them. This is what I'm really trying to do. So I have this first part, which tries to give a broader picture of the structural conditions, themes, important trends, and genealogies behind the Quran interpretation that is happening today. And in the second part, I try to give concrete samples. So I use texts, or I translate texts and then comment on them. For example, to give an idea of how media informs Quranic interpretation, or what role various kinds of Islam play, and things like these. And I use works in Arabic, Indonesian, Turkish, English, German, and a very little bit of French and Persian for that.
And okay, so let's talk about the Indonesian context for a couple of reasons. One, we happen to have a fortuitous history of an encounter in Indonesia at a Quran conference where I got to learn a little bit about your research. And also, I mean, I think it's North America, my sense is that Islamic studies scholars take for granted that we have, you know, Indonesia, it's the most populous Muslim majority country in the world, yet still people don't pay that much attention to it. And so what's your experience been like looking at this incredibly important issue of Quranic exegesis in Indonesia that a lot of scholars don't necessarily pay attention to?
Yeah, I mean, I personally find it absolutely fascinating because, I mean, Indonesia is just, it's a huge country. There are loads of Muslims. It's got very high quality and interesting educational institutions. It's also very diverse. Then one factor that is very important, it has a very high degree of freedom of opinion when compared to a lot of other Muslim nation state contexts. So really a lot of different actors freely express their opinions on how the Quran should be read. It has a very, a nation state that very much, I mean, a government that very much engages in religious discourses, but at the same time, it's a very diverse country with lots of languages and communities. And I'm actually at the moment trying to learn Javanese, which is the biggest regional language in Indonesia, in order to give my research on Indonesia some more depth and to get at these regional traditions. So I think that it is a really, really important field, and that also a lot of very interesting ideas on the Quran are developed in Indonesia. And at the same time, I think it receives very little attention, partly because of the contingencies of the field, because in Europe, as much as in North America, we have a specific tradition of Islamic studies that emphasizes Arabic and maybe Persian, and that's pretty much it. So in Germany, we also have a certain tradition of including Turkish, but if you do anything else, it becomes quite difficult to find a position. So it might be bad for your career to focus on a country like Indonesia because, well, one of my funding applications was actually rejected because one of the reviewers wrote that Indonesia is marginal to Islamic studies. So, wow. And I think this sums up a very widespread perception.
Yeah. Wow, that's intense. As you said that, I was thinking, have you encountered any kind of situations where people belittle your interest in Indonesia? So I think that's amazing that you have that experience.
I need to demonstrate that I do Arabic as well, and then it's okay. If I only did Indonesia, that would probably be a problem.
Uh-huh. And right, I think by the 7 languages you're looking at, I think. Mm-hmm. But I guess some people have their bar higher and you need 15 or 20. So we'll see. So you mentioned Indonesia. Did you do field work in Indonesia? I know you visited bookstores and have interacted with academics. And so you might consider that field work. I don't know.
Yeah.
Could you tell us?
For this project, that's mostly what I did. I also talked to people in various contexts who hold Quranic studies circles. I don't consider myself qualified to do any actual ethnographic work. And at the moment, I don't have the, simply don't have the time to spend enough, a long enough period in any country to actually do the kind of observation I would need to do in order to do this properly. But what I tried to do as much as I could was to visit bookstores, to see what's available, to see what people recommend to me, to ask them for their reasons, to then take notes on these talks, to talk to colleagues. Also, when I wrote my chapters about Indonesia, and this is also a very interesting thing when you write about the contemporary period, as in, I mean, what's happening today. I actually know a lot of the people I'm writing about, not all of them, but I know some of them. And yeah, this is, I've been thinking a lot about how to deal with this. I think I stated quite clearly in my book, wherever that's the case. And I also, I consulted a number of people I wrote about in order to get biographical information, for example, or to just check that my translation is what they wanted to convey. I didn't allow them to actually change any of my commentary or whatever, or to alter the meaning of their text. But yeah, I tried to take them into this project and to involve them somehow. And yeah, I think this is also, this reflects a big change in the field, because, I mean, if you worked in Germany 30 years ago as a professor, you could be, you were in the position to be a German academic who wrote about Muslims, about things that happened in other regions of the world. And this has changed a lot. Today, I'm in a field that's much more interconnected. I know I write about people I know, and they might actually read what I write. They might also write back, or they might write about me. And I'm simply not that removed from what's actually happening within exegetical discourses anymore. I try to take an outside perspective to the extent that's possible, but I'm only half outsider.
Uh-huh. So at the risk of essentializing, what would you say in your look at Indonesian Quranic commentaries today, what would you say are some of the salient features that you've encountered when compared to commentaries from other times and places?
Okay, well, first of all, I have to point out that in this current book, I'm not limiting myself to Quranic commentaries. I'm talking about Quranic interpretation in a broader sense.
Sure.
So I've also got YouTube videos and stuff like that.
Sure.
But I wrote the German language book where I really specifically looked at Quranic commentaries. And what I found there was that Indonesian Quranic commentaries, first of all, they are influenced by a certain extent, to a certain extent, by their colonial history. Second, they have a higher tendency to refer to modernist Arab works of exegesis than actually Arabic Quranic commentaries do. For example, the Tafsir al-Manar or Jamal ad-Din al-Qasimi, who wrote in Syria in the beginning of the 20th century, or the Tafsir al-Marari, which was written in the 1940s. It has even been translated into Indonesian language, and so has Muhammad Abdu's Tafsir Juz Amma, which practically nobody in the Arab world knows. So this was a big difference, and this was also related to a lot of differences in content, and sometimes also... Yeah, sometimes it's just a tendency, and sometimes it's actually a big difference. For example, when you talk about God, whether you describe God predominantly as wrathful, punishing, etc., or whether you describe God predominantly as being merciful, etc. I found a lot more of the merciful tendency in Indonesian and also in Turkish Quranic commentaries. I also found a higher interest in philosophy and in Sufism, which was mainly rejected in mainstream works of Arabic exegesis.
Uh-huh. What about, so you mentioned Turkish as well. So if we're going to look at the sort of understudied, areas of the Muslim world, at least in the Western Academy, what kinds of salient features did you encounter in the Turkish commentaries?
In the Turkish commentaries, the modernist tendencies are even more pronounced. This is very strongly connected to the fact that traditional institutions of Islamic higher learning were completely abolished in Turkey in the 1930s. And then at a later stage, beginning in the late 1940s, they founded theological faculties in state universities. So this was a completely different kind of education, and most of the material I looked at was written by professors emerging from these faculties. They emphasized a lot of, I mean, they marginalized the classical disciplines of Islamic learning to a certain extent, and instead they emphasized, for example, religious studies and other issues from the Western humanities. And this is clearly, this is very much evident in a lot of, even in the style of the Quranic commentaries, the way they use footnotes and in the kind of sources they use and so on. In Turkey in particular, there were really big debates about the whole issue of whether God is a merciful God and whether that merciful God will also allow Jews and Christians access to paradise or not, which was a question that was very closely related to Quranic exegesis because it was directly, it was a direct contest over the interpretation of Quran 262. And this was an issue I looked at in one of my projects, and I found that Turkish exegetes were most likely to have a very inclusivist attitude, to at least towards Jews and Christians, and Arab exegetes were least likely.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to go back and revisit something you've said that I think connects both of the projects we're looking at. And you've talked about one of your interests in Quranic commentaries is the role of the nation state. Could you say a little bit about more about that? Why do governments care about how people interpret the Quran?
I mean, of course, not every government cares about it to the same extent, but practically all governments are interested in monitoring or even regulating religious discourses because they consider them potentially disruptive. There are various areas in which nation states take part in exegetical discourses. And one of them, which is very important, is through educational institutions and especially institutions of higher learning. So in Indonesia, for example, you have state Islamic universities with specific curricula set by the state. In Turkish, you have the theological faculties. In the Arab world, you have institutions such as the Zaytuna in Indonesia or Al-Azhar in Cairo, which are also very much controlled by the state, but adhere to the much more traditional curriculum. And this very much influences the kind of exegetical works that are then produced, because especially with the more extensive works, they are usually written by scholars who have the time and means to do so. And even the less extensive works are often produced from people who were trained at these institutions. And on the other hand, there's also, of course, a kind of counter discourses. So we have exegetical works that are clearly written in order to challenge a specific state. And the Quran is seen as an, or Quranic exegesis is seen as an ideal form of expression because the Quran has such an uncontested authoritative status that nothing else can rival. So if you can prove that your government tries to falsify the Quran or contradicts the clear injunctions of the Quran or something, then you have successfully attacked the authority of your government. And this is what we can see in many cases in Indonesia, in the Arab world, in Turkey, and so on.
Uh-huh. What about in a non-Muslim majority context? And so you mentioned that in your monograph you look at German commentaries. Does the German government care about correct Quranic interpretation?
Oh, yes, very much so. But this is, of course, a completely different interest. I mean, in most, I think you can't generalize. When you talk about Germany, you talk about a very specific system of relation between religion and state, and you would certainly have to modify it when talking about other countries. I mean, essentially what all Western countries share is this fear of Islamic terrorism and this desire to promote a version of Islam that is nonviolent and possibly tolerant, modernist, etc. So the whole issue of women is also, of course, a very big one. And in Germany specifically, the German government some years ago started to fund several centers for Islamic theology at big state universities. And of course, the question what is actually being taught there and what should be taught there is a big question that has been debated a lot. So, of course, there's a lot of interest.
Mm. Well, this sounds like a really cool book, and I look forward to seeing it in a few months when it comes out. Before we wrap things up, could you, what comes next after this monograph? What kinds of things are you working on currently, or do you expect to be looking at in the next several years?
One issue that I've started to be interested in a lot is Quranic exegesis around the turn of the century, so 19th, 20th century. I mean, if you hear names such as Muhammad Abdu, you think superficially, okay, he's a really well-known person and probably everything that can be said about him has been said already, which is absolutely not true. As I found to my own surprise when writing an encyclopedia article about him, for example, he wrote this tafsir on the last part of the 30 parts of the Quran for educational purposes. And this has hardly been studied. This has just not evoked any big interest outside Indonesia, at least. So this is one thing I would like to look at in the context of this whole time, which was very much characterized by new images of history, the relationship towards Christians, towards Europe, etc. These were all debates that played into the interpretation of the Quran. And this is also connected to the whole issue of Muslim-Christian polemics, which surged at this time and also influenced the way in which the Quran was read, but also evoked a new interest in the Bible on the part of Muslim exegetes. So this is a very interesting period of time, and I would really like to do more on it. And another thing is to pursue what Andrew Rippon actually proposed in the edited volume on Tafsir, to come back to that one, to look at translations of classical works of Tafsir. For my recent monograph, I looked at a very short excerpt of an English edition or an English translation of an abridged version of Ibn Kathir. Mm-hmm. Ibn Kathir is today the pre-modern Quranic commentator. He's sold everywhere. There are lots of translations and so on, but nobody has looked much at these translations so far. And I actually found it very intriguing because, I mean, first of all, these translations are always abridged. So the question is, what do they leave out? What do they consider important and what do they consider unimportant or maybe even wrong? And then, of course, yeah, how do they structure the work? How do they translate the terms he uses to a possibly not that educated readership and so on? And I would really like to do a comparative reading of translations of Ibn Kathir into English, Bahasa Indonesia, Turkish, French. There are all kinds of languages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds exciting. I would think that would be particularly useful in a teaching context as well. At least in my case, I find my students are always intrigued by how things are translated and what sort of secret or not so secret motivations could be. So sounds like an exciting classroom tool as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, Johanna. That was fun to see the connections between your two works and to hear about what we can expect in a few months when the monograph comes out. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, and you're welcome.
That was my conversation with Dr. Johanna Pink, professor of Islamic studies at the University of Freiburg, Germany, about her co-edited volume with Andreas Gorka, Tafsir and Islamic Intellectual History, Exploring the Boundaries of a Genre, published by Oxford University Press in 2014. Thank you for listening.